And a warm welcome to Afternoons with me. I'm Bill Arnold. Thank you for joining me today. It's going to be a great hour, great day, as a matter of fact. I've got Dr. Peter Kapsner and Dr. Jim Bilby in studio. We're going to be talking about our event coming up on Thursday, March 26th, right here at the University of Northwestern. We're going to be talking about living in a post-Christian world. Just to make you comfortable, we're going to be serving post-fresh cookies and post-fresh coffee. It's going to be a great night. And right now, I'm looking at the capacity. There's room for 75 people, and tickets are just flying out the door right now. We only have 74 seats remaining. So we're going to want to go to myfaithradio.com and go online and get a seat reserved, because it's going to be a great night. Let me take a quick break, and we'll get things started with Dr. Jim Bilby and Dr. Peter Kapsner.
Faith Radio has been a trusted voice for over seven decades, sharing the good news of the gospel, lifting up the name of Jesus, and helping listeners grow in their faith. And while our mission has remained the same, our impact has grown through AM and FM radio signals across the Upper Midwest and Hartford, reaching additional listeners online and on the app and on demand. And it's your prayer and financial support that equip us in this mission. So join the team and keep Faith Radio going strong by making a gift today at myfaithradio.com.
Faith Radio offers a free resource that will ground you in your faith each week. It's the Prayer Devotional email, and it's easy to receive. Simply sign up at myfaithradio.com under the Subscriptions tab. Then you'll be sent a weekly message with words of inspiration and prayer. It's a wonderful way to connect with God and equip you for the week ahead. Once again, just visit myfaithradio.com, click on Subscriptions, and sign up. You'll be blessed by the Prayer Devotional email.
All right, welcome back to the show. Glad you're with us today. Dr. Jim Bilby, Dr. Peter Kapsner are my guests in the studio. They're going to be my live guests for the big live event on Thursday, March 26th. I was kind of joking about the seats. They're already going fast. So if you want to get a seat, go to myfaithradio.com. On the right side of that page, you will see the special live event with Afternoons with Me. And then you can just sign up to get a seat. Of course, the tickets are for free. You don't have to pay anything. Just bring your lovely, amazing self, and we're going to have a great night talking about living in a post-Christian world. Gentlemen, welcome.
Thanks, Bill. Thanks, right. Bill. Yeah, you've done this live event before, right?
I have,
It's been a great fun,
from
what I understand.
Huge fun.
Yeah.
Huge fun. Yeah. So let's talk about what is a post-Christian world.
Yeah, Jim and I have been talking about this for quite some time, actually. I think you know we've talked together for the better part of 20 or so years, and we're both sort of evangelical church nerds that we grew up at sort of the height of evangelical power, where church was sort of everything in people's lives, from Wednesday night to Sunday morning to Sunday night, to really exerting a lot of social influence in our society, mm-hmm. for sure. And I think all of us have experienced over the last probably 10, 15 years or so, what has been a pretty slow but very consistent decline in church attendance, in church interest, and the rise of a lot of other ways of thinking in our world. And really, truly, in all of that, we've seen a loss of Christian influence in places like government and places like schools and other areas. And Jim, I don't know about you, but I see a lot of people with some understandable angst about this. Is like, oh, we're not even a Christian country anymore. It might be some of how we talk about these things, or Christianity is dying, Christianity is dead. And what we're suggesting is Christianity itself is not at risk at all. But this expression of Christianity, where it exerted social power, where it sort of had its way, where it dictated the terms in our country, certainly that is really changing. But there's a really important invitation in all of that as well.
Yeah, Jesus Christ is unthreatened by all this.
Of course, right?
You know, Malachi, God just says, I don't change, right? Jesus is the same yesterday, today, and tomorrow. And I don't think even authentic Christianity, the kingdom of God, is at all threatened by these changes in society. But clearly there have been societal changes, right? And you can see this in terms of, you know, there's some laws being passed in our land that Christians are sort of horrified by. And we're like, well, how did that happen?
Right.
And then you go back and you study some history and you realize, wow, there's a lot of stuff in our nation that doesn't necessarily fit, you know, hand in glove with Christianity. How did that happen? And you know, that doesn't mean there haven't been and aren't today authentic, sincere Christ followers in all different levels, you know, even politics, you know. Yeah, certainly in different aspects of society. But I think the notion of this post-Christian, or maybe better, post-Christendom concept is one that where Christianity may not be in the position of pulling the levers of society, right, and defining the terms of society and being in, you know, kind of what you might call a position of power over and dictating to society what things look like. But that might not be the worst thing for the kingdom of God. And it might call us as Christians to be in a place of being sacrificial and being, you know, Christ. Christ says he didn't just come down to earth when we had our stuff figured out. He came down to earth while we were yet sinners. And so in a society that is not remotely Christian, how do we as Christians still live, love, teach, come around people? Try to encourage them, show them a picture of a better way of life. And that's what I think this notion of it living in this post-Christian world is all about. I think it's crucial. I'm actually energized by it. I think it's a positive thing.
Well, and you've written a book on transgenderism, and I teach a class on sexuality. And that's one example of, I think, how paralyzed people feel these days. They don't even know how to approach the subject. The norms have changed so much in sexuality. Just, again, for example, that would be very different than the Christian interpretation of sexuality. And many families that I know, and many grandparents I know, and kids I know, they simply don't even know how to talk about this subject or approach it or think about it or wonder about it, all of these different things. And so part of what you and I have been doing has been hopefully thinking through these things, but helping to equip and empower people to have these conversations, to shine Jesus's light in a world in which increasingly Christians are seen as sort of the intolerant minority, or whatever that might look like, and beginning to equip in a different way of life that really does still shine God's light in the world.
Now, you two have been not only friends and colleagues for 20 years, but you're starting a podcast as well.
We are.
I want to talk about that, time permitting, but that will be something that people can go to and hear weekly, monthly?
Yeah, at this point, we're sort of just building all of the libraries of episodes. I mean, it's funny because as we started thinking about it, right, Jim, it's just we've had the good fortune of being in academia for the better part of 20-some years and just hearing a lot of voices and having a lot of stuff poured into us. And this is, if for no other reason, Bill, we think about the 9 kids that we have combined in our families, we sort of said that we wanted this podcast to be something that would be left behind for our kids to be able to navigate a post-Christendom world, which is very different than the world that we grew up in. Yeah. And how can we help our kids think differently about Christianity, but in a way that is faithful to following Jesus, to giving their allegiance to Jesus for their whole life? And that was sort of why we wanted to start it. And we recognize, obviously, there's probably some other people that have some similar questions.
Yeah, and I think for me, the podcast comes out of this place of, I've had the honor of teaching college students for 21 years. That's 21 years of really awesome questions from people that inhabit a different world than I grew up in.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when I'm in high school in the early 80s, that's such a different world than today. And so the questions that are coming out right now and the questions these students are raising are so profound and so interesting and engage, you know, how do we think about the faith in light of this and this and this? And it's given me the opportunity to try to just plow through some of these questions and think about how does Scripture speak to these big picture ideas. And so a lot of what drives this podcast is both our desire to articulate these things for our kids' generation, but it also our past students. I want to do justice to their great questions that have shaped my understanding over all these years.
Right. So, Jim, you wrote a book on transgenderism, and Peter, you teach a class here on human sexuality. What are some of the questions that are coming up all the time?
Yeah, I think one of the main ones is simply, so what do we do when family member X or family member Y comes out and says that they are gay or they are lesbian or they're transgender or something? So many people feel terribly paralyzed, and certainly in my class, and Jim, I know you do a lot of this work too, it's one thing to sort of understand the issues and understand biblically and maybe theologically and historically and scientifically, and all of those things are really important for people. But I think the main question that I see right now is simply, what do I do when my son decides to come to me and says that I am gay? And how do I live that out? How do I walk out life with them? Do I have to cast them out of the home? Do I walk alongside of them? Like, simply, what do I do in these circumstances? I think is probably the most common question that I get today. It's actually a different question than even 10 years ago. That question wouldn't have even been on the radar 10 years ago, and it tells you how fast some of the sexual norms have changed in sort of this post-Christendom world.
Yeah, I mean, and that's exactly it. The conversations are changing, the terms are changing, the landscape is changing, right? How long ago was it that the Supreme Court decision Obergefell came down?
Yeah, it's about five, six years ago, right?
It's
yeah.
five-ish years ago. Before that, 5 years before that, there was a rash of marriage amendments in our society that were being passed, that there are all these – it seemed like, you know, the Christians were finally winning the gay marriage battle, and then suddenly it's shifted. And now you do research on this, you do polls on this, and support for gay marriage is low 70s, high 60s% in our society. And that's like just what changed. And I think some of this is just unpacking what did people always – what were they aiming at when they were saying we're defending Christian marriage, right? And we're defending this picture of marriage. And so often I think that got colored with, well, we're defending you have to look like this and you have to keep these appearances. But it's not about an authentic covenant relationship, because there's so many people – so many Christians are like defending Christian marriage right until, you know, that really cute secretary walked in the door, and then we'll jettison the Christian marriage thing, right? Mm. So the notion of marriage that, you know, has been complicated to some degree by the actions of people who have called themselves Christians, right? And we've been discombobulated by that. And so some of this is saying, suppose we just don't, you know, assume whatever local televangelist is saying, right, about all these things. What does it mean to follow Christ in every area of your life? That's, I think, the crucial question.
Yeah.
All right, we're going to take a little break. Is that cool?
I love it.
We'll be right back with Dr. Jim Bilby, Dr. Peter Kapsner. Make sure you go to myfaithradio.com. Make sure you get a seat for that event coming up March 26th. Be right back. We are back and here from the future is Dr. Peter Kapsner and Dr. Jim Bilby, and they are back saying everything's fine, so that's great.
Absolutely.
And they'll be part of our big night on March 26th, a Thursday night. Make sure you get tickets. Tickets are free. Just go to myfaithradio.com and say, I want to come be part of that, living in a post-Christian world. To be honest, guys, some of that sounds pretty scary. How are you going to help us process that?
Yeah, well, I think it is scary, right, Jim? I mean, I think the landscape has done nothing but shift for Christians over these last 20 years, I think, in ways that we're both aware of and ways that maybe we're not aware of. But what we know for sure, it's shifted. And I mean, I think about even such things. This isn't just about sexuality shifting. This is about the idea of the authority of the scriptures shifting. And certainly behind the scenes in academia, there's been a pretty sustained and sometimes vicious attack on the viability of the scriptures as a guide for life. And so even just answering some of those kinds of questions, very different than 20, 25, 30 years ago in the church, where it was assumed that the scriptures were a place to go as a sense of authority. However you understood them, you wanted to go to them as a place of authority. And that certainly has been under attack. The ideas of just even what constitutes family is under attack. Even church's business is no longer sort of a viable option anymore. I mean, churches cannot economically sustain themselves from a business standpoint unless you're a large, streaming, multi-campus church these days. And so that has changed for a lot of people, where you don't have your local community church anymore. You sort of stream something in, maybe in a gymnasium at best. And so stuff has changed in endless, endless topics. And when things change as rapidly and as regularly as they do, it does create anxiety because we don't necessarily know where to plant our feet.
Yeah, and I think there may be some people out there listening that are, you know, older generation, that are 65, 70, 75 years old, and you might be looking around and you're saying, no, it doesn't seem like things are that different for me. There's, you know, weird things going on in politics and the world and things, but maybe your life is pretty clear and your practice of faith is pretty much, it feels pretty similar, and maybe your church feels pretty similar. But where this is being seen most clearly is in the responses and engagement of younger people with the faith. And so there's this group of people that are called the nuns. And what they're called the nuns because they are asked questions, what is your church involvement? And they, you know, tick down the various options. And You know, I'm Roman Catholic and I'm Baptist and I'm Lutheran. And then the last one is none. And the number of people that would have in my generation, so I graduated high school in 85. In my generation, the number of people that would have checked that box as none was low single digits.
Right.
Right. So maybe as high as 6% or something in that neighborhood. But now that number is high 30s, pushing 40% of people that are 18 to 35. So just has gone through the roof. And so some of this, these conversations about what does it mean to live in a post-Christian world is living in a world where this younger generation just does not look at institutional church in the exact same way that we did, that that their perspective has been radically shifted. They may still, and there's even a term, they may be faithful nuns. They may still have some sort of faith, but they don't see that faith articulated in any traditional church. And so what we have is a societal shift of, I think, pretty epic proportions.
Yes.
And Peter, I think you're right. We're still figuring out what this looks like.
Yeah, certainly.
It's working out in all sorts of ways, but it's a really significant shift that we have to grapple with.
And I think the heart of it is that Christians no longer have the social kind of power that they were once used to wielding, to having the influence that they had. And that loss of power, I think, again, creates this perception that is understandable, but I think is a big miss, that, as you said earlier, Jim, Christianity itself is not at risk. Jesus's kingdom is not at risk, but the way that we function within this world is needing to shift. I mean, just even the sort of the collision of world religions that I wouldn't have grown up with, just because we didn't do a lot of airplane travel and a lot of internet. We might have heard of exotic world religions like Hinduism or Buddhism or some of these other religious patterns, but we wouldn't be asking questions, should we start our worship service with yoga? And certainly there's plenty of faithful evangelical covenant kinds of churches that are beginning to incorporate different kind of religious practices along those lines, and people have a lot of questions about them. So it's, I think it's one of my favorite things to think about with the event, Bill, is that I had an opportunity to be in a couple of churches just doing some different talks over the past couple months. And the time that was the most electric of that whole time was just the question and answer time. I mean, Jim and I are not going to sit here and monologue for 15, 20, 30 minutes on that evening. It's a time where we can just dialogue and ask these questions. And it was, that time was fabulous and fascinating in the church. I think a lot of people have a lot of questions.
Yeah. And I've ordered the chicken wire fence. So there'll be a barrier between you and
perfect,
the audience.
Yeah. Especially if you can stop the tomatoes for sure.
Exactly.
So yeah, indeed.
Exactly. All right. Let's talk about power over, power under. What does that mean?
Yeah, you have a pretty good description. I mean, really, Jim, I mean, we just talked about it in our podcast a little bit about the difference between power over and power under.
Yeah. So think of the language of power over is, think of it for me as a teacher. As a teacher, I am power over. If I'm like, students, you have to believe this. You don't believe this, you don't pass.
So you do, right? Me. Yeah.
Well, I'm clearly, but you're wrong. So
yeah. Clearly.
No, I mean, so that power over mindset is I dictate. This is, you believe this, you believe this, you believe this, you believe this. And I indoctrinate them into all these things. And then I pass them if they can spit back all the right information. Power under sort of mindset in a teaching context. Sure, I'm going to define some of the key terms. What do we mean by this term? What is the issue? What are the debates? What are the history? But then I'm going to seek to try to enable them to engage these conversations for their own. So I'm going to, instead of teaching, this is what you believe, I'm going to teach, here's one way of thinking about this. And here's some strengths associated with that. And here's some weaknesses. Here's a different view, right? And, you know, maybe a lot of Christians don't believe this, but you know, here's why some people would hold this view. And the advantage of this is that I think there's an old adage that if you only know one view on a particular issue, you don't even know that one view. That we best understand even the views that we currently hold by truly understanding what different people might hold on these. So a power under perspective, again, in this context of teaching, tries to enable, tries to empower, and tries to help people make decisions for themselves. Let's be honest. This is what we do with our kids.
Yeah.
We hopefully, when they're little, if they're running in the street, we grab them. We pick them up out of harm's way. We don't let them run in the street. But as they get older, we try to give them more and more responsibility so they can make good decisions for themselves. And so this power under perspective from a Christian perspective maybe means that we are not going to be in the position of pulling the levers of power in culture, that we don't get to define the terms of the discussion. But you know what? We're still going to be present in that culture in the world, not of the world, mm-hmm. but in the world and engaging people and loving people and trying to show people a different picture of what it looks like to live a kingdom world.
Yeah, and there's nothing relative about what you're saying. You're not advocating for a relativism that just says, hey, kind of you decide what you want to believe. It is a different method of inviting people into the kingdom besides sort of forced conversion or using a position of power or a place of power to tell somebody what to think. It's simply inviting them into the beauty and wonder of God's kingdom in a way that kind of you're more of a guide. You sort of lead them. And the way of leading is always through the lens of love in God's kingdom. It's a willingness to sacrifice your own well-being for their well-being. And boy, if we Christians could learn to shine that kind of light in the world, where it's not about our comfort and it's not about making sure we find our church and church shop for what matters to us and it better be the right product and all of the ways that I think, again, we understandably think about these things, but maybe there's an opportunity in light of the loss of social power to find the authentic way of God's kingdom love.
You know, and let's be honest, if this was all about just getting people to say, I'm a Christian, and right. that was enough— then you threaten them, you cajole them.
The Crusaders were awesome at that.
Yeah. Then that's what you do. But if this is truly about a relationship, which I think we believe, then you cannot threaten anybody into love. You cannot, you know, intimidate somebody. You cannot force somebody into committing their life to Jesus Christ. And so as a relationship, it has to be something that they make their own. And so how do we come around them? How do we support them? How do we encourage this decision to be made on their own, with their own? So that's the right. notion of power under, is that we don't have any – it's giving up on the illusion of control, because let's mm-hmm. be honest, it's always been an illusion. We've never really had the control over society, over government, over our kids that we have maybe wanted to have. And so what do we do if we are instead of trying to come from that power over perspective, if we are swapping that out for a power under perspective? I think that's the essence of what we're trying to talk about here.
Yeah.
I think it's going to be a spectacular night. And if you are if you have not made plans, you're going to want to do that today. Go to myfaithradio.com. Come to the live event with me. It's going to be March 26th. It's a Thursday night. Just as a point of reference, the Twins open their season that afternoon. So we will be celebrating a big victory Oakland Athletics.
Yep.
And then we'll be all in a good mood, right?
For sure.
And so bring your questions. I'm still figuring out if I'm going to order the dunk tank or not. So you guys are cool with that, aren't you?
Certainly.
We'll flip for it.
I would love to do it. Actually, I think, though, your listeners would be far more interested in seeing you get a little soggy.
I agreed.
No respect. I tell you, I got no respect. All right. Go to myfaithradio.com. Make sure you get tickets. They're going fast. They really are. And myfaithradio.com. Live event March 26th. Thanks to Dr. Jim Bilby and Dr. Peter Kapscher for being here. It's been great.
Yeah, great to see you, Bill.
All right, take a short break. Rob Louie's next. Well, that music belongs to Rob Louie. He's executive editor at the Daily Signal and a regular guest on the show on Tuesdays. Rob, welcome.
Hey, it's good to be back, Bill.
Thank you so much. How are you feeling?
I'm feeling fine.
Good.
And most of my colleagues are as well.
Terrific.
We were right there in the thick of things at CPAC, but we're fortunate that so far there's no sign of any coronavirus or COVID-19
nice.
Symptoms. Although I will tell you, Bill, that Washington is consumed with this story. I'd actually be curious to know if it's as all-consuming in Minnesota and other parts of the country as it is here, because this is the only thing that anybody wants to talk about.
Well, I think everyone is curious to find out what the government response is going to be. So I do think we're looking to Washington, D.C. to say, what are the programs, what are the plans, what's the information, what is the CDC saying?
Yeah, and you know, it's interesting because it's one of those moments. It reminds me of, because of all of the background noise with the stock market, I mean, what a fluctuation.
Oh.
I mean, down,
wow.
So big yesterday, and then, you know,
way
today,
up today.
Way up today, although not all day. I mean, it was up, and then it went down, and then it went back up. So a lot of market fluctuation, which I think always puts people you know, they tend not to focus on the stock market when it's just the average day, right? I mean, you could have gains and losses, and it goes by without anyone noticing. But when you have such big fluctuations, I mean, almost five percentage points today, I think it raises alarm in places like the White House and Capitol Hill. And when you combine that with all the concerns that are already on the front of their minds, with constituents who might be sick and people looking for answers that may be hard to come by, you really have a situation where there's a lot of uncertainty and unknowns. And so far, it seems that Congress is doing the responsible thing and having some deep conversations about what it is that they might do to address this. The president and Speaker Pelosi both have competing ideas, which is not to be, it is to be expected. I mean, you wouldn't expect a Republican and Democrat to necessarily agree right up front. But ultimately, I think that in a situation like this, most times people put aside some of their partisan rancor and try to work together and show the American people that that there's a way out of this, and hopefully it can be a targeted way out of it. What we don't want is to be using this, as Rahm Emanuel once said, "Don't ever let a crisis go to waste." We shouldn't be taking that attitude. We should be taking an attitude that let's address the problem at hand and see what we can do to fix it.
And of course, the American people are hoping or demanding information from their government. And I don't know if the government is in a position to say this is exactly what's going on, because how can they really know?
That's right. I mean, I think that it's a very good point. I mean, in many respects, we have government officials who are still trying to figure that out. So, there's always this need to know, and I think it's particularly accentuated because we live in a world where people expect instantaneous information. I mean, a story breaks in the morning and they want an answer and a solution in the afternoon. And sometimes we just don't we just aren't able to provide all of those answers, Bill. And so that can be frustrating to people, and I think it can raise anxiety and stress levels. And we just have to remember that this is something that they call the novel coronavirus for a reason. It is something that's new, and we don't necessarily have every single answer. But the CDC does provide some really helpful information. I know that we've shared it broadly here at the Heritage Foundation and Daily Signal. We're trying to do stories on it to educate our readers, and we're trying to do so without creating that mass hysteria that I think some media outlets can be guilty of. When it's all coronavirus 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, it leads to this perception. But yes, I think people are taking the necessary precautions. But just before I got on the line, I got a note from the big school system here in Northern Virginia that they're going to postpone, they're canceling classes on Monday, so teachers can focus on how to do distance learning should they need to do that. So those are the types of things that I think provide some reassurance that there's planning and thoughtfulness being put into these in the event that we do need to go to a heightened situation.
Rob, it is interesting because there's so much attention, of course, on this. And every time we hear of a game that gets canceled or a school that gets closed or a country that gets quarantined, your imagination runs wild. Yet in the news this week, there was a seizure in Escondido of 46 pounds of drugs, including 5 pounds of fentanyl, enough to kill 1.2 million people.
That's right. it's really interesting because for as much as this has dominated the front page of newspapers and cable TV networks, we still have an opioid crisis in this country. And fentanyl, as you just indicated, can kill a massive number of people, even in small doses. So, there are other day-to-day activities that certainly don't get the attention that they deserve. And we should remember that. I mean, heart disease still kills, is the leading cause of death in the United States, is, I believe. And that is something that you don't necessarily read about every day. But that's just the nature of the media, Bill. And like I say, this is something new. It's certainly in some ways political. I mean, you have seen some politicians in Washington try to politicize it for their own gain. And that's just the way that things go sometimes. I mean, I remember back in 2008 when we had, the stock market crash and TARP and the bailouts and everything that was going on, and everyone was such an urgency to act that it didn't even seem that people were taking the moment to think through some of their decisions. And I really just caution your listeners to seek out that advice that they need, try not to panic, and take things a day at a time here, and I think we'll get through this.
Mm-hmm. Rob, talk about borders and open borders, and that's going to be an ongoing threat as well with the coronavirus, isn't it?
Well, certainly. I mean, Italy has essentially shut down the entire country. I mean, so that's just one dramatic example of one country. But yes, closer to home, Mexico and Canada, you know, obviously our neighbors, we would expect them to act responsibly. And the president has talked about how it was making some of those early decisions to close down travel to certain countries that probably prevented this from spreading more than it already has. You know, there's always second guessing. You know, should we have acted sooner in some cases? And what should I think we can go back? What should China have done? I mean,
yeah.
Should China have really taken a more aggressive approach early on to try to contain it? So this never even left China. That obviously didn't happen, and now we have over 100 countries throughout the world who have people who are infected. And yes, that is going to make some tough decisions for people. When it comes to international travel and people, you know, friends and family who might have things planned. I know from talking to people just here, I mean, they've canceled their trips. They've decided that it's not worth the risk. These are international trips. And you know, in many cases, just postponing them until later in the year when they can do that. And it seems that most of the airlines are willing to accommodate those changes, which I think is a good move on their part.
Rob, when you think about it, there's an open food market in Wuhan, China, and there was some contaminated or virus that got passed, and all of a sudden there's a global shutdown of sorts. It's just hard for me to wrap my head around.
It certainly is, but it just goes to show, what an interconnected world we live in, and how, particularly with international travel. I mean, if this had happened 100 years ago, wouldn't have had that because, you know, people weren't getting on airplanes and then taking it to Washington State or California on the West Coast. Look, Bill, just to take one example locally, I mean, think about what just happened at the Conservative Political Action Conference. You had an individual who has tested positive, who didn't know that at the time, who happened to be in the green room. And you have several members of Congress, Senator Ted Cruz, Congressman Paul Gosar, Congressman Doug Collins. They were all, you know, either in contact with that individual, shaking a hand or talking to him. Now, in all of their cases, they haven't exhibited any symptoms, and it seems that they might come out of the 14-day period fine. But at the same time, I mean, now everybody's questioning, well, geez, we didn't interview any of those three for the Daily Signal. It just so happens. But, I mean, say we interviewed Ted Cruz. Well, then it raises all sorts of questions about whether or not, you know, you've come into contact with somebody who came into contact.
Mm-hmm.
It seems that the risk of spreading it like that is unlikely because you need to have sustained contact with somebody for more than just a handshake or a quick hello. These are some of the unknown questions that we have, and why I think it's best for anybody who might be experiencing symptoms, and why I think doctors are recommending that they just remain at home and in a self quarantine and wait till that incubation period passes.
Rob, have you heard about the possibility of social mitigation concerns, where they might have you stand further apart from people when you're out in public, that kind of thing?
I do. So, you know, we had an interesting – the church I attend on Sundays always has a very friendly peace offering, shall
mm-hmm.
I say, where literally you go around to almost every pew in the church and you shake somebody's hand and greet them. And we love it. I mean, it's one of the things that really attracted my wife and I to this particular parish to begin with. But the rector on Sunday was very clear that, maybe fist bumping or elbow tapping or just a friendly wave is a more appropriate thing. So we have adapted, even in our own lives, in that respect. I've had visitors come in and shake hands, and I think we just need to be mindful that it's best to wash your hands more frequently and take some of those precautions. But yes, keeping a distance, particularly maybe from those who you don't know really well and don't know where they've been or if they've had international travel in the recent past, not necessarily a bad idea. I think the one thing to keep in mind here is there are certain populations that are more vulnerable once they get the disease. And so for children actually don't appear, at least according to the data we've seen, to be particularly vulnerable. But there are other individuals, particularly those over 60 and 70 years old, you know, who it affects more.
Mm-hmm. Rob, I should probably be talking about this story more than you, but it did appear in the Daily Signal. But it's an event that's happening here in my hometown of Minneapolis-St. Paul. And the City Council of St. Paul has voted unanimously to designate March 10th as Abortion Providers Appreciation Day.
Yeah, I know. It's... I don't know what to say about it. I mean, it seems like we live in two different worlds, where there are those who value the sanctity of human life, and then there are those who, you know, want to honor the very people who terminate pregnancies and terminate human life. So I don't really understand it. I will tell you, though, that as you know, the Supreme Court was just debating last week the Louisiana case, just hearing arguments in the Louisiana case. I mean, I do think we have a greater appreciation for some of these issues and for life than we have. I interviewed the Louisiana Attorney General after the argument, Jeff Landry, and he said sometimes those of us who believe in the right to life forget all of the progress that we have made. You know, since the Roe v. Wade decision. And oftentimes we point to the technology, but just in terms of changing hearts and minds. So it's unfortunate that the St. Paul City Council, you know, voted establish Abortion Providers Appreciation Day. But at the same time, I hope we can take something like that and use it as an opportunity to maybe educate those who don't fully understand or see things our way, and do so in a way that's graceful and that's loving, and hopefully change their minds on an issue that we care so passionately about.
Mm-hmm. Rob Louie is my guest. He's the executive editor of the Daily Signal. You can always head over to dailysignal.com. We'll take a little break. We'll be right back. My guest is the always great, never less than sensational Rob Louie, executive editor of the Daily Signal. Rob, I'd love your godly take on the words of Chuck Schumer outside the Supreme Court.
That's right. You know, as we were just talking about, the Supreme Court heard this big case coming out of Louisiana in which they require abortionists to have admitting privileges into hospitals. It seems like a rather reasonable and responsible requirement for the state. They, after all, they require other types of doctors to have the same type of admitting privileges. And it was at that court hearing that Chuck Schumer really went off and railed against both Justices Kavanaugh and Gorsuch, saying that they will pay the price for some of their decisions, using language that was interpreted by many, if not Schumer himself, as a personal threat to both of the justices, just steps from their offices. And so naturally, you would expect this to get the attention that I think it deserves. And you had the typical reaction. You had those who are in some of these liberal media organizations who spin it as Republicans seize on Schumer's comments, as if the Republicans were doing something inappropriate there. And so I think it was important, though, for Mitch McConnell to go onto the Senate floor and to make a statement about this, and for others to try to censure Schumer. This is the type of language that has really created this tension in our culture, and we can't even have a civil conversation. And I go back to the case that's being decided, Bill, because I think it's so important. We're not talking about an end to abortion. We're talking about requiring doctors, requiring abortionists to have admitting privileges in hospitals in the event that something goes wrong while they're performing an abortion. And just as, you know, if you were doing a gallbladder operation through laparoscopic surgery or something like that, you know, you would expect your doctor to be able to treat you and care for you in a hospital if something unfortunately went wrong. And so, you know, it just goes to show, you know, where you know, the politicians in Washington are going. And I'd like to also point out that, you know, Schumer never really he backtracked from it and said he used the wrong words. But I didn't hear an apology. I mean, he really owes Justices Gorsuch and Kavanaugh a real heartfelt apology, and I was disappointed that didn't happen.
And, you know, even Justice Roberts said what you said was dangerous. And when and when he does not apologize for that, and he issues a kind of a wimpy non-apology, I don't think that's not satisfactory.
Right, exactly, and I know we seem to be living in a society today that doesn't believe in apologies, and that goes for President Trump as well. I mean, he has said it, never apologized. I personally take a different view on that. I think that again, my advice is that you know, nobody's perfect. God didn't create us you know, to be perfect. He expects us to make mistakes. Maybe you know, there are some days where we're better than others, but ultimately we have our sins, and we should ask for forgiveness, and if we make a mistake. And so I honestly do believe I grew up in New York, upstate New York, as I think some of your listeners might know. There was a period of time when Chuck Schumer, you know, was a senator, and I was there, so I know a little bit about him, probably more so than other senators. I've met him. Every July, I run a 15K road race. Chuck Schumer always comes to the race. I've had my picture with him. I genuinely believe that he's somebody who's a reasonable person, even if I disagree with his politics. I think this was clearly a case where he overstepped and said something that warranted an apology. And when that didn't happen, it was really disappointing, because I think it sets a poor example for others, and certainly a poor example for the young people in America.
No, I couldn't agree more. All right, Rob, we've got more primaries tonight. What do you think?
Yeah, the next two Tuesdays are going to be, I think, big deciding points. It's really interesting because coming out of Super Tuesday last week, obviously. You know, there's a reorientation in terms of the media anointing a new front runner. So what we will be watching for tonight is, seems that Michigan is going to hold a lot of answers, because it's a state where we're not really sure, I think, which way it's going to go. It's one of those Midwestern states that Trump carried in 2016, so it could hold some decisive answers for the Democrats. Washington State's another one. Obviously, Bernie Sanders has done well on the West Coast, winning California last week. And you go down to a place like Missouri, and, you know, so we shall see. It is going to be really interesting to see how this race shakes out and how long both of them duke it out, and whether they stick out, you know, right to the convention, or somebody decides to bow out early.
What has been your thought when you see all of the people that were debating against Joe Biden now stepping up to support him?
It's really surprised me how quickly everybody has moved in that direction. I didn't expect it to happen as suddenly as it did, but I suppose that, you know, when you're in a situation and you realistically think that there's no shot for you to get a nomination, and really if somebody's ultimately going to blame you. I mean, think about it. Ralph Nader is still being blamed for Al Gore's defeat in 2000, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that'll always be, you know, something that is associated with him. And I think some of these candidates, you know, depending on where they come down on politics, may have felt that kind of pressure and decided that it was, you know, best for them to get out. Or conversely, Bill, maybe they're looking for their next move, and they feel that a quick endorsement may yield a plum position in one of these administrations.
Mm-hmm. Rob, how do you think the coronavirus is going to affect the rallies and the campaigning and all that going into the election?
Well, so as we were talking, you know, news just came through that Bernie Sanders' campaign has canceled a rally in Cleveland as a result of coronavirus concerns. So I do think that we were just talking, Bill, about those who are most vulnerable if they were to get the disease, the virus. And you have two candidates who are approaching – well, three candidates who are approaching 80. We might as well include President Trump in there because he's doing rallies of his own.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of interaction and contact you could be having with people who, you know, potentially could be carriers. So I think that my recommendation is maybe just you limit the handshakes, you limit the selfie photos, you know, maybe practice some of that distance. But, you know, you really would like to see life go on, and certainly these rallies is a really a core part of campaigning in American politics. So I don't think that they'll step away from it. I know Senator Sanders has said that it must go on, and he's planning to do so.
Mm-hmm. I saw yesterday where Vice President Biden spoke to a group and only spoke for 7 minutes, and I know there has been some criticism about his wellness and all of that. What do you hear in Washington, D.C. on that?
Well, you know, it's something that I think the President Trump and his team will be looking to exploit. There's no doubt about that. You know, it's really interesting because some of the social media networks have said that the video that some of the people associated with the Trump campaign were sharing of Biden and some of his remarks and gaffes was in violation of their policy as you know, manipulated media or misleading media because it didn't show the full clip. So we're presented with these types of things, and I think it's only going to continue as this campaign drags on. So I'm not hearing a whole lot of chatter about it, other than the fact that that he's somebody who's been known to occasionally have these moments, and we probably all are. But you know, for some people, it happens a little bit more often than others.
Yeah. Well, the canceling of the rallies, that's kind of a big deal.
It certainly is, and we'll see if it's the first of many or if it's just an isolated incident. But it's really one of those things that, particularly think about the Trump campaign. I mean, this is what they have been known for is doing these massive rallies. They did one in Pennsylvania last week in Scranton. You know, they are really using those to fuel a lot of the energy and excitement. So if you're not able to gather a large group of people like that, I think it certainly would change the dynamic and strategy behind some of their plans.
Mm-hmm. Rob, what is your prediction on the Olympics? Gonna take place or not?
Well, based on some of the other big cancellations that we've seen, I mean, I was really surprised to see South by Southwest cancel its conference, Facebook cancel this big developer conference. Obviously, those are two that draw, you know, from around the world. So, I mean, I think some events that, like the Olympics, that pull from different places are faced with a really tough decision. I think the next few weeks are going to probably be critical. If we start to see cases level off or decrease in the United States, I think given the tests that have will be coming out, I mean, I think you're probably going to see cases increase initially, but if things start to taper off, maybe the Olympics will be spared. But those are the types of decisions that need to be made well in advance as people start making travel plans.
Yeah. Well, Rob, if there's serious talk about canceling the Olympics, I might suspend my decathlon training. Because
well, that's too bad, Bill. I was looking forward to watching you.
Well, I know. I'm sure you were. Rob, thanks so much for doing the show. I will look forward to our talk next week.
Thank you, Bill.
You bet. Rob Louie's been my guest, executive editor of the Daily Signal. You can always head over to dailysignal.com. I encourage you to do so. There's some great stories. Rob writes, and as all of his colleagues have got spectacular stories. We'll take a little break. When we come back, hour two, we've got Ace Collins. He's written 103 books. Ace, get a hobby. Anyway, this book is on stories behind the songs and hymns about heaven. That's going to be a great hour. Be right back.